Ik ben niet zo groot, dus ik krijg een krukje om jullie ook allemaal te kunnen zien. Wat fijn om jullie gezichten allemaal vandaag hier te zien. Ik denk dat we hiermee een krachtig signaal afgeven dat we het opkomst van fascisme absoluut niet tolereren. Hier in Amsterdam niet en in Nederland niet. Op 20 september togen meer dan 1000 fascisten door Den Haag om hun frustratie rondom migranten of migratie en links te botvieren. Deze ruilschoppers trokken een spoor van vernieling door Den Haag, pleegden geweld tegen de politie en gooiden de ruiten van een partijkantoor in. En binnen een aantal uur was er bijna een ton aan schade aan monumentale gebouwen. Die dag in Den Haag waarschuwden ook mensen elkaar met een migratieachtergrond elkaar, vooraf om vooral niet de straat op te gaan. De angst regeerde die dag in Den Haag. En dit mogen we niet toelaten of normaliseren. Deze angst horen we ook de afgelopen dagen op social media en in verschillende appgroepen. Mensen werden opgeroepen om ook vandaag niet de stad in te gaan, omdat veiligheid niet gegarandeerd kon worden. En ook die angst regeert dus in Amsterdam. Dit is verdrietig, maar ook om echt woest van te worden. Daarom heb ik samen met Here to Support op het Museumplein een duidelijke waarschuwing afgegeven in een vorm van een metershoge projectie op het Van Gogh Museum. Fascisten, niet welkom in Amsterdam! Aan de fascisten die vandaag naar Amsterdam zijn gekomen voor hun anti-migratie-demonstratie. We say it loud and clear, jullie zijn niet welkom. Vaker zijn we met KZP doelwit geweest van fascisten en racisten. Het geweld waar wij mee geconfronteerd werden op tientallen plekken is niet te bevatten. Maar het is wel realiteit. En al jaren staan we tegenover dit geweld. Iedereen stond erbij en keek ernaar. Het is zorgelijk te noemen dat deze haat door ons kabinet als normaal bevonden wordt. Dus ga naar die fucking stembus op 29 oktober. Kies medemenselijkheid, radicaal antiracisme en solidariteit. En jullie weten op wie jullie moeten stemmen. Haat en racisme en fascisme horen nergens thuis. Niet op onze scholen, niet in onze straten, niet in Amsterdam, niet in Nederland. Siamo tutti antifascisti! Siamo tutti antifascisti! Siamo tutti antifascisti! Nu niet! Nooit niet! Toen niet! Nu niet! Toen niet! Nu niet! Dank jullie wel. Uh-huh.
go out. And New York City is sort of horny. It's crowded out for the show, and we are ready to go. We are going disco.
Hello and welcome to the Eurasian Knot. I'm your host, Sean Guillory.
And I'm your fellow co-host, Rusana Novikova.
The Eurasian Knot is sponsored by the Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies at the University of Pittsburgh, and you lovely patrons out there who give us monthly contributions to help us keep this podcast running. As I've said repeatedly in the last couple of months, your generous donations are increasingly important. So please consider becoming a patron by going to patreon.com/eurasianknot or to the podcast website, eurasianknot.org, and find the link to Patreon and sign up and just give us a few bucks. It's very helpful. So how are things on your end?
Oh, things are going pretty well. The semester is drawing to a close.
Ah.
Drawing to an end. Yes, so I just have a final to proctor in a few days, which was scheduled weirdly from 7 to 11 p.m.
What?
I know. Oh, 7 to 10 p.m. It's like the last possible time slot on the last day of the semester. Yeah, and so then I have to grade those finals, and then I'm in the clear for the winter semester.
And are you teaching next semester?
Yes, I am.
And what are you teaching?
I'm teaching Foundations of Social Theory at the interdisciplinary program here.
Nice. And what's the most interesting reading you have on your syllabus?
Well, it's not my syllabus.
Well,
I'm a teaching assistant.
Syllabus.
I'm looking forward to revisiting Durkheim.
Oh.
Haven't read that one
old school.
A really long time. Yeah, it's a bunch of old school people.
Oh, okay.
Weber, Durkheim. I think there is some Foucault. Yeah, I don't remember exactly what else. But yeah, it's pretty comprehensive.
Yeah, kind of foundations, as you said.
Yeah, classical texts. So I'm excited about that because it's actually social theory. This semester we taught Marxism and liberalism.
Oh.
And even though, I mean, obviously I find Marxism is close to my heart, but still... I was like, oh, no, I don't want to talk about, like, surplus value anymore.
What was what did you read about liberalism that was actually interesting?
Well, fortunately, I didn't because I was on maternity leave. I didn't have to deal with it.
Oh,
so I literally came back the week that they started talking about Marxism.
Ah,
I see. Perfect timing. Perfect timing.
That's convenient.
Huh, yeah, okay. But even that kind of... Yeah, that got old really fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. Hmm. Ah, well, that's too bad that you didn't get to revisit liberalism.
I know they read Locke, Mill, Stuart.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, also classical texts, but I was like, oh, thank God I didn't have to deal with that.
All right. Well, I'm happy to say that we have a winner for our joke contest.
Yay! Where are the...
I think I don't know.
Some sound machine?
No,
yeah.
Do I have some? No, that's not good. Let's see. Wait. Actually, I like that one.
Yeah.
Me too. Okay, that's a...
Oh, this one is pretty good too.
Oh God. Stop. Okay.
This is like giving me Super Bowl vibes.
Yeah, I don't know if I have a drum roll one, but let me see. Maybe there is a drum roll. Large robot. Oh no, this changes my voice. Oh no, I don't have drum. Oh, that's strange. Okay, well, I might keep some of those in. That might be fun. Anyways, the winner is a listener named Christoph, who I now know lives in Hungary because I asked him for his address to send his prize. And this is the joke he won for.
During the darkest 1950s in communist Hungary, four strangers get into the same train seat box. It sounds like a beginning of a mystery novel. It's a long ride. They're bored, so they start drinking, and after a few shots, they decide that they'll pass the time by telling jokes. They take turns at telling jokes, and one of them tells a really good one about Rakosi. All four of them are laughing like mad. It takes at least 5 minutes to slowly stop laughing. One of them, still giggling, says, "Man, this was really, really good. Oh, I really need to write this down. Okay, so what's your name and your address?" Yes, this was pretty good.
This is a good one. Well, thank you, Christoph. You'll be getting a prize in the mail, hopefully sooner rather than later. I don't know what the state of mail is now with the tariffs and stuff. I don't know if this will matter, but yes, I will send you a prize. And I'll say what the prize, I don't know what the prize is.
Oh yeah, a prize. We're keeping the mystery.
It's a mystery prize. It's a mystery prize. Anyways, that was a lot of fun. Maybe we should do this joke contest, you know, every once in a while. And people can continue to send in jokes. And we have a bunch of backlog. We also have some sounds we need to play. So maybe once we get into the new year, we'll start picking those things up again. So, All right. So if you have a joke or a sound, you can send it to us. You can send it through our contact page at yourknot.org/contact. And if you're sending a sound, tell us what it means for you. If you're sending a joke, even, you can tell us what it means to you. And we're looking for jokes. We're looking for like jokes from communist societies. It can be from anywhere in the world, like the one that Christoph sent in and won our prize. It's about Hungary. So if you have any jokes from other communist states, we'll certainly welcome them.
Okay, why don't we jump into the interview? So this week, you interviewed Alexis Lerner about post-Soviet graffiti.
Yes.
Unfortunately, I couldn't be there because I had office hours. So I'm very curious to know, what was your favorite part of the interview?
My favorite part of the interview? Oh, boy. My favorite part of the interview actually is when Alexis was talking about the types of graffiti that she really likes. Like I asked her at one point, like, what is your favorite graffiti? And she told about that. I really liked it. And I also liked her telling me a bit about these graffiti artists because she actually went around and hung out with them. She went on a couple of graffiti like painting nights, and just hearing about those kinds of people and how they do their art and what they think about it is actually really interesting to me. So that would be my favorite part.
Where did she do her research?
She did her research in St. Petersburg, Berlin. I want to say in Budapest. And a couple other places, I can't remember. She has a list. So, and she's been collecting them, and she actually has a website where people can go and see the graffiti that she's taking pictures of, which is, I mean, in the hundred. I mean, the book itself has like over 100 pictures of graffiti. So it was really cool.
Wow, that's impressive. I bet they were really nice places to hang out in.
I bet. So, and you know, to hear about like particularly in authoritarian states, like what role does graffiti play and its the politics around it and its political efficacy is something else that we talked about that I found interesting. So, yeah. All right. Well, why don't you go ahead and introduce Alexis for us?
Alexis Lerner is an assistant professor of political science at the United States Naval Academy. She's the author of Post-Soviet Graffiti, Free Speech in Authoritarian States, published by University of Toronto Press. You can see the Alexis Gallery of Graffiti at postsovietgraffiti.com. Here's Alexis Lerner.
All right, Alexis, it's great to talk to you. Thanks again for reaching out and letting me know of your book. I guess John Bushnell's book on graffiti, I mean, that's the only one I knew of. So it's just you, him and yours now?
That's right.
Okay. And his book was published, like, I have it somewhere over here on my shelf.
In 1990.
It was published a long, long time ago. So I guess this is a topic just waiting to be picked up by someone, that someone being you. And your book is called Post-Soviet Graffiti, Free Speech in Authoritarian States. And, you know, the first question I have is, why graffiti?
Thanks so much for having me. I should offer, before we start, a general disclaimer that the opinions and statements in this interview are my own and not those that reflect the U.S. Naval Academy or the Department of Defense.
So back in 2009, I was an undergraduate and I was living in St. Petersburg, Russia. And every day I would walk with my roommate along Nevsky Prospect all the way down from my apartment to St. Petersburg State University to on the island. And as we did that walk, we would see all of this graffiti, these stencils, stickers, freehand writings about jailed political prisoners, about nuclear policy, critique of nuclear policy, and so on. And it was all really free and critical of the Kremlin. And it led to these bigger questions of, well, is this just a St. Petersburg thing? Is it true beyond St. Petersburg? Is it true outside of Russia? And so I went back to the States and I went back to school and I started getting funding to go back to the region. And I ended up going all the way from Berlin in the west to Vladivostok in the east over the course of 10 years, looking at how people express themselves using graffiti, how they circumvented censorship in a variety of different types of regimes, but of course with a focus on how they do it in the most closed of regimes in the authoritarian states.
So as we were talking briefly before we started recording, your book is the only book I know of besides John Bushnell's book on Moscow graffiti from 1990, which he deals with a bit of the late Soviet period. Why don't you give us a brief history of graffiti in this region that you've looked at?
One of the coolest things about doing ethnographic work is that you, over time, talk to all of these people and you get to sort of cross-validate the stories they tell. And so one of my interviewees is this guy named Basket, right? I use their pseudonyms that they choose for themselves as graffiti artists. And Basket told me this amazing story of it's the late Soviet era. He's sitting in a cafe in St. Petersburg. And if everybody's pretty, especially young adults, they're looking for something to do with their time. And he's sitting there all day drinking the same cup of tea. And there's a TV in the corner and they have a VHS of Beat Street. And if you've seen the movie Beat Street, it's about breakdancing in New York City. And in the back of all of the breakdancing, you see the trains of Manhattan covered in graffiti. And that was really powerful for Basket. And so he connected with his two friends. They go over to Riga where they can find, you know, the paint factory. And so they go to the paint factory and they get the paint. They bring it back to St. Petersburg. They start painting. And he tells these stories that some babushka was walking by and how she commented on what they were painting. And there wasn't this immediate aversion because there was no precedent really for it. I mean, John Bushnell, as you say, he talks about it a bit. And he talks about, for example, the hippie movements as shown through graffiti and some of the nuclear movements. Certainly some of the Victor Tsoi graffiti happening in the late Soviet era. But this real explosion of graffiti used to express political discontent and political sentiment is huge in this like early post-Soviet period. Then these guys go on to create a school of sorts, right? So they start training the next generation of artists to, and of course they're often paid to be there. So they train the next generation of artists in how to paint and how to create something that I guess in 2025 we turn to YouTube or social media to do. But you know, at that time, this happened in person. And this next sort of second gen artists, they came to paint in a time that not only were they being trained by people who sort of learned by doing, but also they came to become artists in the time of these graffiti festivals. And these graffiti festivals were initially sponsored by these international corporations. So Nike, Nescafe, Monster Energy Drink. Even the U.S. consulate at some point, I think it was in 2011, sponsored one of these. And all of these different organizations would have their own agenda and they would bring these artists to paint a skateboard deck or a pair of shoes or whatever. They were often told no politics, no porn. And they would create and they would be given, you know, paint and they would be given space to make art. Of course, they were completely taken advantage of and these international corporations then used their products and used their art in order to make a profit overseas. So they were learning from the first wave. They were getting more experience through these festivals that were very popular at the time. That brings us to sort of the present day where we have conservatism, nationalism, patriotism. There's a closing, a consolidation of the authoritarian state in Russia. This is post-2022. There's tensions between the U.S. and Russia. There's sanctions. There's a proxy war in Syria. There's all of these different things happening that create sort of a crackdown. And so what happens with the third wave is some of those second wave artists and even first wave artists are invited to quite literally come out of the shadows and paint on behalf of the state. These beautiful large murals about Maya Plisetskaya on like national Soviet icons and different cultural leaders, but also about military leaders. I'm sure you've seen maybe on the old Arbat, there's this big mural of General Zhukov looking out over the Arbat and sort of over Victor Tsoi, the Tsoi wall where people would come there and write peace-thick graffiti. And so you had these artists that were being invited to paint for the state explicitly. Anybody who wanted to create real subversive art was sort of pushed to the outskirts of society. So that's the trajectory of graffiti from the early 90s, late 80s until today.
I don't know if they talked about this at all, but I'd be curious to know if they did. You know, in the Soviet period, street art of course, was widespread in terms of the state's propaganda. Did they reflect upon that Soviet tradition of a state-sponsored, in this case, again, street art and the kind of messages that they were trying to provoke with that propaganda?
Oh, 100%. And so we go from any, you know, a Soviet consolidated autocratic state to a post-Soviet consolidated autocratic Russia. And we see these trends from both time periods of the state using these sort of six-story murals, which dominates public space. It co-opts artists, it co-opts the art form, and it's able to control narratives. And so, yes, someone walking down the street might think, oh, that's just a pretty colorful image of Maya Plisetskaya. I did a talk a few weeks ago, and one of the women in the audience said, oh, I was a ballerina in Moscow, and I remember going with all my ballerina friends, walking down the street, seeing Maya Plisetskaya. We used to take selfies with it. And, you know, yes, in some ways, there is a plausible deniability that it just beautifies the space. But there's also this bigger story of when you see this, it tells you which sort of leaders you're supposed to glorify, what sort of narratives are supposed to be dominant. And surely that's reminiscent of the Soviet era. Absolutely.
You say this in one point. You said that street art is a narrative of a place, right? It's supposed to, as you walk through that space, it's supposed to make you understand that space in a certain way. Can you talk a bit more about what you mean by this narrative of a place?
One of the most wonderful things about graffiti is how highly localized it is, especially when it's political. And so, for example, in Riga, Latvia, there's the Lady Liberty Monument sort of in the middle of town that exemplifies everything about being, you know, Latvian independence and celebrating being Latvian. And there's this very nice image, well, nice, there's a very detailed image of Lady Liberty going through a meat grinder. And this idea that it's a critique on the European influence for Latvia and the Baltic countries to make their own identity small or even non-existent, unrecognizable, in order to be welcomed by the European state or the European mass. And so that's maybe specific to Latvia. Whereas in Berlin, in Germany, in 2014, I'm seeing images of Holocaust survivors jumping rope with barbed wire, which is, we know that in Germany, people do talk about the Holocaust in schools and with young people, and it is a part of the national narrative. I saw, for example, in 2011, kind of literary and cultural figures as celebration of the Belarusian people, despite the state's ties, you know, as opposed to the Belarusian state and its ties with the Kremlin. In Osh, in Kyrgyzstan, there was a lot, especially in 2010, about the ethnic conflicts happening between the Uzbek and Kyrgyz people in that town. And sort of they would say, well, Uzbek people aren't allowed to trespass in this area. Kyrgyz people aren't allowed to trespass in this area, and so on. So there was a lot of derogatory graffiti in that time. And of course, in Moscow, right? So you would see a stencil of Peter the Great in an artist district with the words, "A tsar will only be a tsar as long as one believes him to be a tsar," right? And so this just this very highly local idea of what matters in a place. I also always believe that graffiti has this role of circumventing censorship. So it depends, what are the issues? What's the hierarchy of issues being censored in the first place? So in one place, it might be ethnic conflict, whereas in another place, it is, I don't know, talking about Putin in the political leadership, or in another place, maybe speaking about minority issues like the Holocaust, you know, or something in Berlin. It's also true outside of the post-Soviet region. This is by no means unique to the post-Soviet region. We have all these abandoned buildings and abandoned post-industrial spaces, and you would see graffiti referencing Hurricane Katrina and how it damaged New Orleans back in 2005, and how that is so drastically different than what happened with post-industrial collapse and white flight and riots in the city of Detroit. And so you have this highly local story of whatever the political issues are for that community.
And you also have a struggle, being, like you said, it's a way to circumvent censorship. And it's a struggle over like who belongs in that space, who owns the space, not owned in terms of property, but who owns in terms of who has the right to speak or to be there. And then, of course, you get into this cat and mouse game of you get graffiti and then it's painted over, and it's this constant kind of narrative battle.
Yes, but there's agency in that. So yes, you see a narrative battle of if it says Lukashenko sucks on the wall of a bus stop in downtown Minsk, it's going to be gone really fast. But if you see Jews are vermin on the wall of a Jewish day school in Budapest, it might stay up for 6 weeks. And I think this tells us something really important about government agency too. What is tolerated and what is not tolerated? And that differs state by state as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a really good point. So you talk to a lot of these street artists, interview them about their craft, their art. Why don't you tell us about some of them? Who are they? What's their background? As you said, like you made the reference to Beach Street, you know, a lot of graffiti is inherently connected to a variety of different kind of marginal subcultures. Where do these people fit in?
I'll tell you a little bit about how I found these people. I used couch surfing. It was this tool for people to find other like-minded people who wanted to open their home to strangers. There were a lot of gatherings among couch surfers. It was a whole thing. So I went on couch surfing and I would look up, right? And I would look up all the different cities where I was going to go. I was going to go to Budapest. I was going to go to Moscow, whatever. And in every single place, I would look at who was in that location and talked about graffiti or street art in their profile as one of their likes, right? You would hyperlink their likes. And I would reach out to them. And for those that responded, I would give them this sort of very quick questionnaire. And they would tell me what areas I should go to, who I should speak with. You know, is there like a so-called graffiti wall? Like in Prague, there's Lenin Wall, where everybody would come together and kind of write if they wanted. And I would talk to these different people. And I would, if they were amenable, I would talk to them a little bit further. And ultimately, I would make these maps. And I would make a map of every single city I went to. And each map would have six locations. It would have an artist area, a downtown area, a student area, a market area, sort of an end of the line area where we take the train or subway out to the end of the line, and a so-called graffiti spot where graffiti was approved to exist. So again, Lenin Wall or Five Points in Long Island City kind of place. And I would go to the area, I would go to Moscow, and I would go to all these different locations, and I would collect all the different graffiti that existed around there. And I would also ask these people on couch surfing, would you show me around? And often they would, and I would go around with them for the whole day. And then I would ask them at the end of the day, will you introduce me to somebody else, the graffiti artist community? And over time, I was able to develop relationships with these people. So I would go back to Moscow year after year after year, and I would get together with these people. We would have kids. Our kids, you know, would come over each other's houses. And it was really, it's really nice.
What types of people are they?
They are all kinds of people. They are, some of them are wealthy, some of them are not wealthy. Some of them are women, some of them are men. The women in particular would often say that they were able to, they believed, get away with some things that their male colleagues weren't able to do. There's one woman in Budapest who would draw different graffiti just right out in the public, and she would wear kind of a construction worker vest. And she said nobody ever bothered her. One young woman in Moscow once told me that she got picked up by the police and she was very worried. And they took her to the police station and they asked her to make a mural. And so she went in the police station and she drew a mural for the officers there.
Let me ask you about this, because like even the word, say, graffiti, at least in the American English context, it has all sorts of connotations, right? It has to do with like urban decay. It's coded with like hooliganism or vandalism. And then street art, when something is called street art, it inevitably has a higher kind of aesthetic appeal, right? A more artistic. Do you make a distinction between these two terms, or is it important to make a distinction, or are they just interchangeable?
I acknowledge in the book that in the art history world, there is an important distinction between these different works, of course. Street art is anything from fancy murals to someone taking off the top of a fire extinguisher and painting onto a wall, to someone using moss, right, that grows over time to paint. There are lots of different ways to create public art. And of course, graffiti generally has this implication that it's illegal, it's subversive, it's destructive, it's ugly.
It also has racial connotations in the United States.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And also gang affiliations, that it's sort of just a turf war and people are just identifying where their space is and who's not allowed there. I do point to that.
Surround the trusted you.
Shine the razor blade in your dream is power. Interpretation.
Señores, tengo que ir a ver a los otros dos. The path is clear, though no eyes can see. The course laid down long before. And so with gods and men, the sheep remain inside their pen. Though many times they've seen the way to leave. He rides majestic past homes of men who care not or gaze with joy to see reflected there the trees, the sky, the dilly fair. The scene of death is lying just below. The mountain cuts off the town from view, like a cancer growth